This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 13th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I am Markus Hippi and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily and The Ten. Coming up, the Turkish election results. We hear from our Istanbul bureau chief on what the impact of the unexpected outcome is.
He had an interesting quote this morning, which was he said that Turkey has returned from the edge of a cliff, which is from Demirtas, you know, and really he's basically saying that somehow Turkey was facing a kind of dictatorial mode from Erdogan, and that their passing of this 10% threshold to some extent has opened that door a little bit more for a more broader party.
The results of Monocle's Quality of Life survey are out now. We hear which cities made the cut and why.
It felt to us it was a really good time to award the city the number one position. Good architecture, safe, secure, polite, and just very interesting place to live and to visit.
Also in the program, as used Airbus A380s are becoming available for sale or rent, we ask if Airbus is next facing competition from itself. We will also discuss nudity in Sweden and how Apple's new music service is going to change the industry, or is it? All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Markus Hippi. Let's start in Turkey. For the first time in 13 years, on Monday, people were waking up to a new government that is not controlled by the AK party. In the weekend's election, the party managed to secure 41% of the vote. This means it has to form a coalition to avoid entering a minority government. Also, the pro-Kurdish HDP crossed the 10% threshold, securing seats in the parliament for the first time. On Monday's edition of The Briefing, Robert Bound spoke to our Istanbul bureau chief Chris Lord. Before that, we heard what some of the voters had to say at the polling stations on Sunday.
I'm not so hopeful, but my only hope is was the June uprising in 2013. And I think if we will have a solution for the politics in Turkey, that will be an election of the people, but not the parliamentary parties.
It's going to be risky for the country because of the structure of AKP and the actions of the Prime Minister. AKP should not be in power for another 4 years. There are many wounds and scars that have been opened in the past years, and only a coalition can solve this.
Everything is wrong right now. It's basic rights of people. For instance, in the last week, four people have been killed. They were supporting HDP, and they were killed because of that. And I think, you know, even basic human rights are in danger right now, and in the next term, I hope it's going to get better.
And that was voters yesterday. Now we're going to speak to our Istanbul bureau chief, Chris Lord. Chris, welcome to the programme. What's the bottom line on the election here, to be honest, for the AKP party and for Erdogan?
I think the AK party, what they've woken up to this morning is the reality that they've not got the absolute majority that they were hoping for in this election. One of President Erdogan's key ambitions of this, obviously he's the president, so he actually has to remain to some extent kind of a little bit neutral in this whole process, but actually he's not done that at all. But in fact, one of his ambitions in this was to get an outright majority for the AK party, which would allow him then to actually change the constitution and turn Turkey into a presidential system, so actually remove the post of prime minister, therefore giving him, to some extent, not absolute power, but certainly the head of government, and not sharing that power with anybody else in Turkey.
And a lot of the Western press have called this a snub for Erdogan. Is that how it's being reacted to, or is it a little bit more complex than that in the press in Turkey?
Well, as you well know, Rob, it depends which press you ask, really. I mean, the pro-AKP press is certainly coming out and saying that Erdogan should now begin calling the next round of elections, which is a possibility in this whole scenario. So if they can't form a coalition government, then Turkey will go back to the polls. If you look towards some of the opposition press or the slightly more critical press of Erdogan, certainly Hürriyet, for instance, had a very interesting editorial from Murat Yetkin, who's one of their key writers there. And this morning he's explaining how really this marks the end of what he calls Erdogan's rise in Turkey. You know, this is the beginning of a faltering of that very strange trajectory that he's done over the last few years towards a sort of, you know, even increasingly what some call autocratic mode in Turkish politics.
And a lot has also been made of the Kurdish Obama, in quotes. This is a former lawyer called Selahattin Demirtas, who's obviously helped the Kurdish parties get over this important 10% threshold in the parliament. Chris, can you tell us a little bit about this character?
Well, Demirtas is an interesting character. I mean, really, the HDP, the HDP, which is this sort of quite broadly leftist party in a certain sense in terms of minority rights. Yes, they are a pro-Kurdish party, but they've also kind of expanded that to include LGBT rights in Turkey, other minority groups that exist in Turkey. And Demirtas is an interesting character. He's the co-chair of HDP, and he is very popular. I mean, when yesterday, as you mentioned, I went to the polls yesterday to an area sort of just outside the centre of Istanbul, and it was very interesting to talk to people about their interpretation of Demirtas, especially your more kind of liberally minded, secular minded people. And they really sort of, a lot of people do see HDP as this kind of tempering force in Turkish politics. One of the things that's been very interesting to observe is how ideological this election battle has been. I mean, you know, really, in a way that sort of in Western Europe, it's maybe a bit difficult to understand or not quite the same anymore. But really, you know, Turkish politics is so segmented along ideological lines. And I think what HDP represents actually is something that's a little bit softer. He had an interesting quote this morning, which was he said that Turkey has returned from the edge of a cliff, which is from Demirtas, you know. And really, it's interesting to think that he's basically saying that somehow Turkey was facing a kind of dictatorial mode from Erdogan, and that their passing of this 10% threshold to some extent has opened that door a little bit more for a more broader party.
And maybe you can look into your crystal ball briefly and tell us what the next steps might be, whether there's going to be another vote, whether there's likely to be a coalition government. What do you think will shake down from this, Chris?
I think staying on the subject of the HDP and Demirtas, I think it's interesting to note that he absolutely said he will not form a coalition government with AKP, with Ahmet Davutoğlu and so on and so forth. He will not do that, and that is a key part of his agenda. So if he won't form a coalition, the Nationalist Party that has said that they will not form a coalition either. So really, I mean, we're actually reaching a point where, you know, someone's got to step in if they are going to form a coalition government and to some extent renege a little bit about what they said before the country went to the polls. If they go back to elections, this is something that really people don't want to consider at this stage. You know, elections like this slow the country down quite significantly. Markets have been hit by the possibility that Turkey would enter a coalition government. And I think a lot of people really want to sort of move beyond these elections and start looking ahead to the future now.
That was Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief Chris Lord speaking to our Robert Bound on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference took place on Monday in San Francisco. A major part of what was announced was a new music service costing $9.99 a month. But what does that offer that's new? Well, on Monday's Monocle Daily, Peter Cardwell and Paul Osborne caught up with Monocle's tech correspondent David Phelan, who was in San Francisco. He talked to us through some of the day's big announcements.
It started with the inevitable descriptions of exactly what's coming up in software for the iPhone, for the iPad, for the Apple Mac, and even now for the Apple Watch that will come in the autumn. And then it suddenly moved into something everyone had been expecting, but seemed very striking, which is Apple Music, which is Apple's answer to streaming situations like Spotify and Tidal and other services like that.
So what is different with this new service with Apple Music? What does it do that Spotify, for example, doesn't do?
Well, I think it's come about because obviously Apple set up iTunes years ago, and it's a very useful place to go and buy music from, and Apple has made it work very well. But they've never got into streaming, and they realized this was an important thing to do. So last year they bought Beats Music, Beats Electronics, for $3 billion, and more for the streaming service that Beats already had rather than the headphones that the company also makes. And what they've done is, in order to answer your question about what's different about it, is they've tried to make something that does three things. First of all, it'll be a place where, just like Spotify, you can stream music or download tracks for offline use. But then there'll also be a thing called Beats One, which is a radio station that will be broadcast from three cities, New York, London and Los Angeles, around the world simultaneously from the new Apple Music app that will be on iPhone, iPad and later in the year on Android phones as well. And then the third section is called Connect, which is a place where any artist, whether they're Pharrell Williams or an unsigned artist no one has ever heard of, can upload, well, really, whatever they want, photographs, video, lyrics, or anything else, music indeed, so that fans have a kind of direct access to these artists.
David, you mentioned that, as usual at these things, that Apple announced all sorts of new updates for all the various devices that people carry around with them. Another update for the operating system that runs their computers. I just want to check this with you. Is this the new version of Apple's operating system genuinely going to be called El Capitan?
I knew that was going to be your question, and yes. They've taken to calling the operating systems after Californian landmarks. And so the current one is called Yosemite, and El Capitan, I believe, is within Yosemite, and that's why they've continued that naming system. But
so they've sort of run out of cats, and now they're going for these landmarks.
That's right.
Then.
Yes, exactly. They made quite a big thing 2 years ago about there weren't any cats left after they'd done lion and snow leopard and mountain lion. I was looking forward to OS 10 tabby cat, but they never went with that.
Moggy.
So yes, they exactly.
They've
so
gone with something gone far more sensible.
Yes, it's always a surprise how they name these things, but yes, El Capitan it is.
And presumably there'll be a question mark over all of these various updates that some of the older phones, iPods, etc. will mysteriously now slow down.
Well, that is usually the case, but they did two things today that were quite departures for them. First of all, usually what happens is the oldest supported phone each year drops out of the system. So the iPhone 4S has iOS 8, the latest operating software. You would have expected that in the autumn that will not be supported anymore, but in fact it is. So everything that gets the current software will get the next lot. And they've also made the new software much, much smaller in terms of the space it takes up on your phone. Hopefully, they say that it won't slow things down because it's a much smaller file. And indeed, performance is one of the things they focused on for the iPhone, so that there'll be a low power mode, which will apparently add 3 hours of usage when you're running out of battery. You can invoke this special mode that will make it last longer.
That was Monocle's tech correspondent David Phelan speaking to Paul Osborne and Peter Cartwell after the first day of Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference on Monday. It is next time for a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. Almost 8 years after carrying its first paying passengers, sales of the Airbus A380 are facing some new competition from itself. Market watchers are preparing for a new phenomenon of used A380s becoming available for sale or rent by the airline industry. Airbus hasn't taken any new orders for the A380 in 3 years, but it insists that the used market doesn't pose a problem. Well, on Tuesday, Monocle Syke Enright spoke with Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International.
These used planes are the first A380s that went into service with Emirates and one or two other airlines almost 10 years ago. So airlines such as Emirates have a very, very strict turnaround policy. They tend to recycle their aircraft after about 10 years. And a lot of these A380s are, you know, of course, used pretty intensively. So they will start to get cycled out of the Emirates fleet and a few other airlines, although Emirates are the big user of this aircraft, and they will appear on the second-hand market. And just as with the car market or the house market, it's supply and demand, more supply on the market tends to depress prices.
So Airbus says that this won't be a problem for new sales at all. And I suppose, presuming these planes will come on the market at a fairly steep discount, but they won't that discount will reflect their desirability.
Yes, I mean, this is the Airbus is right in a way that, in that it won't affect the market because they're not selling any new aircraft, so there's nothing to affect. Their point is that some second-hand A380s, and we're not talking a deluge, a glut of aircraft coming on the market here, we're talking about a trickle, that these aircraft might, because of the price that they'll be on offer for, might attract some new airlines into the A380 market, airlines that weren't looking at the A380 before. Now, these are airlines that might sort of pick up the odd one as a sort of carrier on perhaps mid-size routes because they can obviously carry 500 or more passengers, but we're not talking a huge glut of A380s coming on the market that's going to alter the whole dynamics. Airbus are really struggling to sell this aircraft new, and that's really the biggest problem that Airbus have got. The fact that a few second-hand aircraft are coming on the market is really it's perhaps an irritant. I doubt it will make any effect at all. It'll have any effect at all on whether Airbus sells any more new A380s this year or next.
Put that into context for us, the difficulty that Airbus is facing. I mean, it needs to sell 30 of these aircraft a year to break even. It hasn't signed any new orders for the last 3 years. What's going through the minds of the senior management there?
Well, it has signed a few orders in the last 3 years. It hasn't signed any this year. It signed a few very, very small numbers in 2014. So really, this Airbus has yet to convince the airline world, apart from Emirates, which accounts for half the order book and half the backlog, that the A380 is really a replacement for the 747-400, which, if you remember back in the 80s, really dominated long-haul routes. I mean, British Airways had dozens of them. British Airways has now ordered just 12 A380s and says it isn't ordering any more. Air France, Lufthansa, Singapore Airlines, the other big beasts of the long-haul airline world, are ordering the A380, but not in huge numbers. And if you look at the 777 from Boeing, it is selling far, far more.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International, speaking to Monocle's Tyke Enright. Up next, nudity in Sweden and the results of Monocle's annual Quality of Life survey. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows posted here at Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. How would you feel if a neighbour wandered naked around their apartment? None of your business? Okay, how would you then feel if said neighbour wandered up and down the stairs naked, went all natural in the garden, and took so many clothes to the laundry it seemed they had none left to wear? In Stockholm, this was enough for a man in his 60s to be, well, stripped of his rental lease, despite having lived there for more than 30 years. And yet Sweden has a rather relaxed attitude to nudity, certainly compared to many other European nations. To find out more, Monocle's Emma Nelson spoke to Maddie Savage, editor of The Local in Sweden, which reported on this story.
Sweden is a place known for being a bit more promiscuous than other EU countries. It's always a bit difficult to actually know how much sex people are having in different countries, particularly because when you're asking people about this, you're asking them to give information that no one can really check up on. But there have been a number of surveys suggesting that Swedes have more partners than other Europeans. They're much more likely to have one-night stands than a lot of other European countries. About 48% of people who answered a poll by the big pollsters YouGov in 2013 said that they'd had a one-night stand. You're also much more likely to have an experience of a sexually transmitted disease if you live in Sweden.
Maddie, what I can't quite gather, though, is the fact that is there this genuine connection between a wide acceptance of public nudity and the fact that everybody seems to be getting rather fruity as a result of it? Because in the brief experiences I've had wandering into naked saunas, promiscuity was the last thing on my mind.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important distinction, because on the one hand you hear about Swedes loving to take their clothes off, loving to have sex, but actually in the sauna, nakedness is something that people don't really notice. I mean, colleagues go into saunas naked together. I've got a friend who was introduced to her future father-in-law naked in a sauna, and Swedes do not think that this kind of stuff is weird. And I actually spoke to a few Swedes this evening, and they said, please don't say that we're always getting our clothes off. But the fact is that Swedes do get their clothes off more often than others. There is no kind of prudishness in these kind of public places. There's also quite a lot of public naked swimming over the summer. But having said that, people really do respect their personal space, and I think that's probably a reason why people don't want to be confronted by a 60-year-old man's bits when they're doing their washing.
That was Maddie Savage, editor of The Local in Sweden, speaking to Emma Nelson on Wednesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You are listening to the recap on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. It is that time of the year again. Monocle magazine's July-August issue is out, and we have once again released the results of our annual quality of life survey. To talk us through which cities made the cut, Monocle 24's executive producer Tom Edwards spoke with our editor Andrew Tuck and our executive editor Steve Bloomfield.
Squeezing up one point to take the gold medal position is Tokyo, and gold medal is apposite because the city is kind of gearing itself up in preparation for hosting an Olympic Games. What has struck us over the years is this is a city which, despite its scale, works at a very human level. And that means that there's a kind of a synchronicity about the way the city runs. It's very easy to get around. They're still investing in transport, in infrastructure. They're ambitious about greening the city. But there's also, despite its kind of massive scale, there's a cultural element that comes into play, which means it's friendly. If you're looking for the metro and you're a foreigner, you'll have learned that someone will inevitably tell you how to get there, probably take you there themselves. And actually, while some things are still expensive, the cost of living around food and getting a coffee, all these things are actually surprisingly cheap, especially with the fall of the yen over the last couple of years. So it felt to us it was a really good time to award the city the number one position. Good architecture, safe, secure, polite, and just a very interesting place to live and to visit.
Now, Steve, it certainly piques people's interest in terms of how we arrive at Monocle with these rankings. Some of the metrics may be a little different this year. Perhaps you could sort of explain how they've changed or evolved this time around.
There are about 22 new metrics this year. And I think the important thing to understand about this survey is that it's not simply we ask 100 questions, get the answers, put them into the machine, press a button, and there's a winner. Because on some of these, they're about a feeling, they're about a sense of what this place is like. Is this the sort of place where if you have kids you'd feel safe for them to walk to school? That's not something you can put a score on. This year there are a couple of big things we wanted to add. One was about outdoors. So is this the sort of place where you might be able to go for a cheeky outdoor swim in your lunch hour, you take your towel to work? Is this the sort of place where you can escape quite easily at the weekend to the lake, the sea, the mountain? Those sorts of things, obviously, very important. And is this the sort of place where you can sit outside, ideally in the sunshine, and enjoy a nice glass of wine or a cup of coffee or a good meal? Alongside that, we also wanted to look a bit more seriously at the cost of living, which is something that anyone living in a city has really experienced in the last few years has become a sort of a much bigger thing that people take notice of.
Steve, perhaps you could just sort of run us through just the rest of the top five in the survey. And then, I don't know, maybe pick out one or two other sort of surprises, any sort of new entries or big fallers where people need to mark their cards for how to improve further for next time around.
So as Andrew says, Tokyo is our winner. Vienna rises to number two. It's been a city that we've liked for a long time. It's been a top 10 for a little while. But again, it did quite well on some of the new metrics we introduced. And it's also a city that, as we've got to know it better, you understand more about it. You see parts of it which you hadn't seen before. Another riser, Berlin. That comes in at number three, which is without doubt the best it's ever done. Go back to the issue of cost of living. This is a city where if you're an artist or an architect or a designer or any sort of creative and you want to be working in the heart of Europe, this is the place you're going to go, because you know that you can, even with, you know, some modest rises now, it's still the sort of place where you can get not just a lovely apartment, but you can get a studio as well.
And a nice transition there, I think, from that, you know, poor but sexy image it had to being a bit more efficient. Michael Müller, the new mayor, is doing good things. Just a city that's ready to go up a notch.
Monocle's Tom Edwards there with our editor Andrew Tuck and executive editor Steve Bloomfield on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24, and we finish this week's edition with one of the monologues from the past week. On Tuesday, our editor Andrew Tuck looked at the music industry from record players to streaming services.
I want a record player. I want to drop needle onto vinyl. I want to pull out the sleeve and read the lyrics. I want playing music to be a simple thing. I'm old enough to have grown up in a house with a record player, been a convert to cassettes and then CDs. Then I uploaded my CDs and bought anything new from iTunes. Lately, I added in an online streaming service too. I think I'm supposed to find myself floating in a digital music heaven, surrounded by every band you can imagine. It's the culmination of years of technological advances. So why does it feel so annoying? The first round of grimness is music streaming services. Yes, you can curate playlists, have access with a few taps of your fingers to that album you always love, but that's not really what happens. It's more likely that you'll search for an artist who is not even listed, or look for a version of a track that also appears to be absent. Instead, you're faced with a sea of radio pop, and while I know that Sam Smith and Ed Sheeran are fine musicians, there are limits to how many times you can have them in your house. There is something crushingly narrow about the whole process. So instead, you decide to buy a few things you like from iTunes. Now, the next part is my responsibility, I admit, but it doesn't seem to be a unique outcome. Bank card details need to be updated. Numerous rounds of verification are required. The computer does not recognise your new device. It finally lets you purchase, but for some reason, nothing shows up on the new phone. This was my Sunday. But having just come back from Japan and having spent a lot of time in nice hip bars and coffee stores, I know there is another way. Buy a record player. There are no apps required. You choose what you hear and you settle down and you listen. Sitting drinking coffee as the barista switches the vinyl has a romance and joy that no MP3 file or streamed pop track can ever deliver. Now, you could call this the ranting of a technologically challenged fool, but I'm not alone. Sales of vinyl continue to flourish, and among a demographic that is young and tech-aware. Just as the coffee shop revolution or the food truck movement was about experience and provenance and being connected, so too is the small but important shift back to vinyl and CDs. It's about the tactile, the real. And just as the burger chains and coffee giants got wrong-footed, so too will the music industry if it cannot make listening to music the easiest, most enjoyable moment in your day. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
And that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. This programme was edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Markus Hippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.